Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. The time is 9:01 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Alaska's State Capitol, Room 532, the Senate Finance Chambers. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, on today's agenda is SB 70. It's the Appropriation Limit Budget Process Permanent Fund Bill. I'd like to invite Commissioner Hoffback to the microphone. Commissioner, if you could introduce yourself and your associate. We have a presentation on SB 70 from the Commissioner of Revenue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
For the record, Emma Pocan with the Department of Law.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to briefly go through the Department of Revenue's review of the SB 70 in relationship to what we think are critical components that need to be in any permanent fund restructure bill. Starting on slide three, just real quickly, the use of the permanent fund earnings. There seems to be some disagreement on what the permanent fund was originally established for. So we actually went back to the actual ballot initiative language that created the permanent fund itself. And you'll see that underlying highlighted at the end there, income from the fund would be deposited in the general fund of the state and be available to be appropriated for expenditure by the state. So when there's some concern that somehow restructuring the permanent fund earnings for use for state expenditures was not the original intent of the fund, I believe by the ballot language it was absolutely the intent of the fund that at some point in time we would reach this stage where oil and gas revenues had declined and that the money would be available for appropriation for state expenditures. So why now? Why at this particular date? Well, if we look at the FY18 budget, the budget put forward by the governor was about $4.3 billion in operating and capital expenditures. Since we have about $1.5 to $1.6 billion in revenues, it leaves us with a $2.8 billion deficit that we need to close. At the bottom of this slide are some potential tools that have been proposed to close the gap. I've highlighted the bottom two there because those are the two that this bill specifically focuses on, as well as companion work that needs to be done for the cuts that have been put forward by the Senate. So that with SB 70 net of dividend would yield about $1.9 billion available for closing that fiscal gap, and then $750 million that's been proposed over 3 years in cuts would essentially close the rest of that gap. But you'll see that on that particular slide, there's all the other potential solutions are $100 million solutions. The permanent fund is the only billion-dollar solution, and it's a multi-billion-dollar solution. And we can't get to the finish line with any combination of other tools without using the permanent fund as one of the major components.
Senator Machicki, did you have a clarifying question?
Well, I did, actually. Commissioner, if you can go back, I'm wondering where in the bill, although the Senate majority is proposing $750 million cuts over 3 years, you talked about it being an aspect of the bill.
And that was a misstatement. The bill does not include the cuts, but the cuts have been discussed as kind of a companion to get to the finish line. And we will have some slides at the very end that show why we need to not only just do this, but the rest of the issues as well. So,
Commissioner Hoffbeck, thank you.
So moving on to slide six, over the last 2 years, last year in particular, we had over 63 hearings on various permanent fund restructuring bills. The governor, myself, and Pat Pitney have done over 500 meetings around the state, meetings and presentations talking about fiscal plan and the fiscal issues and what needs to be done. And then best practice of the international other funds, we've kind of come up with these five tests of what's necessary for any restructuring of the permanent fund. First of all, it needs to be have a rule-based framework. Secondly, it needs to be used as a tool to help stabilize the budget moving forward. Third, it needs to protect the dividend. Fourth, it needs to protect the permanent fund itself so that the fund is multi-generational. And then it needs to actually maximize the use of the earnings reserve, because the whole reason we're having this discussion is that we've got a budget deficit and we need to use this tool to its fullest extent. So I just want to just spend a couple minutes and just kind of walk through each one of those real briefly as to why they're important. As far as being rules-based, the greatest threat we have to the long-term fund durability is unplanned withdrawals. So we need a withdrawal system that's designed to protect the fund, guarding against unsustainable uses, and also a program that ensures that the earnings reserve will always hold enough money within the earnings reserve to bridge low earnings years, so that there's always money available. This isn't a short-term fix. This is a long-term structural change in how we're funding government. So we need to make sure that we'll always have enough money in the earnings reserve to be able to fund government services as well as a dividend, even in low earnings years. So we need to have some structure around it to make sure that both of those are accounted for moving forward. Secondly, we need to stabilize our revenues. Over the long term, it's been shown that economies that experience repeated ups and downs grow slower, that a more stable baseline economy is much more fertile for economic growth. And because our budgets right now are driven by a commodity that's highly volatile, our revenues have been more volatile than most, and as has our budgets. And so we see that goals we can achieve by using the permanent fund as a tool for stabilizing our revenues is also we could use them to stabilize the size of government and the size of the revenues going forward, so that we end up with so it can get us out of this four decades of boom and bust budgeting cycles and really give us much more of a stable budgeting platform to work from. Third, it needs to protect the dividend. One of the things that was very clear as we traveled around the state talking about the fiscal plan is just how important the dividend is within just the economic base of the state. It's become integral to the economy of the state of Alaska. And so became very, very clear that we needed to protect the dividend, but that the dividend had to reflect the current and future economic realities of a shrinking oil and gas tax structure, that we just simply don't have the revenues we had in the past. And recognizing that too large of a dividend limits our available options for a full fiscal solution. The way the numbers work out at $60 oil, the size of the deficit is essentially equivalent to the size of the dividend. So the larger the dividend, the larger the budget deficit that we have to fill with other sources, either through cuts or additional revenues. And so the dividend size of the dividend needs to recognize the economic realities that we're facing moving forward. And it has to provide for a sustainable dividend for all generations of Alaska. It can't be one where we maintain a high dividend for a while and then it's just gone. The idea was that it would be something that would be sustainable long term. Next, we need to protect the permanent fund itself. The permanent fund is meant to be multi-generational. It's funding for state expenditures for all generations of Alaska, not to be spent, on the current generation and let the next generation fend for themselves. The idea is that it should be there for all generations. In order to do that, it needs to grow with inflation. It needs to maintain its real buying power as we move forward. So in order to protect the fund, we need to be able to also inflation adjust the fund as well. And so withdrawing too much from the fund is unstable, and it risks damaging the corpus of the fund to the extent that it's not growing with inflation. And then finally, and this gets to the point of, again, why we're actually having this discussion, is that we need to maximize the use of the permanent fund earnings. There's several various versions of a permanent fund restructuring bills out there, and one of the things that we've talked about in every hearing is that regardless of which one people choose, it needs to actually use this tool to its fullest potential. That North Slope production is in decline. We have a nice bump this year, but it's still on long-term decline. Earnings are going to go down from that, and we have to be able to recognize that this is going to be our major tool for funding government services into the future. Right now, we make substantially more on our earnings than we make in oil and gas tax revenue. So withdrawing too little would limit our future options for a fiscal solution. And again, as I said before, other proposed new revenues create million-dollar solutions. This is our only billion-dollar solution, and we need to use it to its maximum. Talk about the modeling, then, that we went through, just real briefly. Key aspects of the model, it's probabilistic. It really looks at a wide range of potential outcomes of oil prices, oil production, investment returns, all using Monte Carlo simulations. We look at variations in what may occur over the next few years. We actually modeled it out for 24 years. And that was something that we had developed internally. We actually brought in McKinsey & Company last year, reviewed our model. They suggested some improvements, but they basically said that they had no major mechanical errors in, but there are some improvements, and we have included those, including probabilistic oil production modeling and autocorrelation that we've added to the model this year. So it's a very robust model for looking at potential outcomes into the future. Some of the inputs and assumptions, we're starting with basically the end of the fiscal year last year. So $54.9 billion in the fund balance, $37.9 billion realized, $9.7 billion in the realized portion of the corpus, $9.7 billion realized portion of the earnings reserve, and about $6.3 billion in unrealized earnings still held within the fund. It's based on the Permanent Fund Corporation end of year fiscal year 2017. Without an inflation-proofing transfer for 17, you can see the various components here. Total returns estimated 6.95%, statutory return at 6.24%, and inflation rate at 2.25%. So these are all Permanent Fund Corporation numbers that we're using. And to the extent that we can, we've tried to use objective numbers wherever we can and not be subjective in the inputs within it. Oil price is probabilistic modeling, as is production, and the CBR has a $4.4 billion balance at the beginning of FY18 and estimating a 2.25% rate of return on that. Our budget assumptions, we have three lines here. The dotted line at the bottom is our baseline UGF revenues for other revenues other than the permanent fund. We have the yellow line, which is SB 70 with $750 million in cuts. The blue dashed line is SB 70. The colors are hard to see here. Plus capital and debt service. That's SB 70's appropriation cap plus capital and debt service. And then the green dashed line is the extended 10-year Office of Management Budget fiscal plan. So you can kind of see the SB 70 appropriation cap is very similar to what OMB had forecasted as far as the forward-looking budgets. And then you can see the delta that occurs with the $750 million in cuts. Modeling scenarios specifically for SB 70, 25% of the royalties deposited in the permanent fund. POMV, percent of market value draw for the first 4 years is 5.25% of the value of the first five of the last 6 years, so the five-year average of the last within the last six. And then beginning in fiscal year 22, drops to a 5% draw. There's a draw limit, which says that the maximum percent of market value amount is reduced by a dollar for every dollar of unrestricted general fund royalties and production taxes exceed $1.2 billion. Dividend is 25% of the percent of market value calculation before a draw limit. So if we start to reduce the amount of the draw based on the draw limit, it does not reduce the size of the dividend. And then there's also an override for the first 3 years that the dividend is $1,000.
Commissioner, we have a question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, going back to the previous slide, number 16, and you have the blue line being SB 70 plus capital plus debt service. What are your assumptions for capital and debt service?
That would be the OMB numbers.
$180 million was on our model, I believe.
So no growth. I don't see growth in capital at this point, other than inflation.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, please continue.
And then on slide 18, we're going to focus primarily on the rest of the slide deck on the very top line, which is SB 7 with a full fiscal plan, which means full deficit closure, whatever way we get to it, whether it's revenues or whether it's expenditure reductions. But the idea is that there's just no additional draws, that the permanent fund restructuring is allowed to just to work exactly the way that it's structured in the bill with no unstructured draw. So it's immune to any UGF deficit, no unplanned draws. Then we have two others that we'll just bring in at right at the very end, and I think they're important to look at, and that's SB 70 with no other measures. That if all we had was a permanent fund bill and nothing else passed, so there's a structural deficit. What that would result in as far as modeling is concerned. And then SB 70 with the three incremental cuts that have been discussed, which I believe is $300 million in the first year, $250 in the second, and $200 in the third, and how that works as far as the durability of the plan. There's been some discussion on slide 70 about the 5.25% draw and whether that is too large. So I thought it was important to really look at what the impact of the five of the last 6 years is on the draw calculation. So this is 2012 to 2017 fund value. The average of the fund value for the first five of the last 6 years is $48.1 billion. 5.25% of $48.1 billion is approximately $2.5 billion. And $2.5 billion in relationship to the actual 2017 value of 53.6 equates to about 4.7% draw. So you see that although 5.25 is aggressive, it is sustainable based on what other experts have been saying, that about that 4.75 seems to be someplace that more people are comfortable with, while the actual real draw against the current value is about 4.7% within these years. We actually thought, well, it's important, let's go back and look at a few more years just to see whether that holds as we go back. So we did it in five-year increments. So from if we just did 2010 to 2015, we see it's about a 4.17% effective draw. From 2005 to 2010, it's 5.32. 2005, it's 4.47. 2002 is 4.02. 1995, 4.36. So you see that it's, and this is consistent, I think, with what Ledge Finances testified, that it's around a 4.5 to 4.7% draw, if you look at that five of the prior 6 years.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a question, Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, how would you feel about the 5.25% draw in the first five of the preceding 6 years with a 5.25% cap? Would you feel like that was a healthier number? We're on the heavy earnings years. We wouldn't rise above the 5.25%.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, there's going to be years where it's going to be a little high. The draw is going to be a little bit higher than what we'd be comfortable with, and there's going to be years where it's substantially lower. And so I think if you put the cap on it, you may artificially constrain the amount that you can draw in a given year, not recognizing the fact that there's going to be years where the 5.25% draw is substantially lower than what the fund could actually achieve.
Senator Michicki, follow up.
So with using your logic, if you use a 20-year horizon, is your estimation that it all averages out and doesn't jeopardize the fund, even without a 5.25 cap?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, yes. And we actually we'll have some modeling that goes 24 years, and you'll see that it is durable and sustainable at the 5.25. This we actually modeled this bill, so we do take the reduction down to the 5% after in 2022.
Senator Michicki, can you? I have the nuance that you're suggesting as a conversation piece, but could you follow up, Senator Michicki?
Well, what I was going to say for my last question is, if we modeled a sort of permanent fund-ish other fund that's well diversified from real estate to equities like our fund is over time, including, I mean, last year we modeled sort of the market, but if you included a more diversified fund, would you say that history has proved that a 5.25% draw on a well-managed, well-diversified fund such as this would be would remain safe over a long span of time, not just the 20-year span, but including historic lows and the kinds of impacts we've seen since the Great Depression?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Machiki, you know, I actually believe that the permanent fund right now is a pretty well diversified fund, and it's projecting 6.95%. The Callan's forecast going forward, I believe, yes, that 5.25 is something that is achievable.
Thank you,
Commissioner. The difference that I heard in Senator Machiki was the current language is a flat 5.25 draw, looking back over the years to get the average. And the nuance that I heard was suggested conversation around language change to say up to, mm-hmm. so that we wouldn't overdraw if we didn't need to. And your model actually proves out that it's significantly up to might be language for consideration of this committee versus the flat 5.25. Did I get that accurate, Senator Machiki? For the original conversation.
I think you're saying that for the public, right? Because the commissioner answered that. Thank you. Yes, that's what I was saying.
Sometimes it's you know, we have attorneys that we're used to listening to and people referencing statute. So for me and those at this committee table know that even though my grandson may not be able to understand what we're talking about, the people of Alaska do. And I just want to be clear that we were specifically having a conversation around language on the 5.25 draw, as well as possible language change that might say up to versus the fixed rate number. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think I like having up to, or I guess rails around the draw, because if there are 2 or 3 or 4 years of decreasing market values, then the draw actually looks more like the 2010 or worse. And so this works, the numbers work, when the fund's value is rising at a relatively stable and predictable rate each year, i.e. 6.25%. Or somewhere around that. We have any kind of losses, and it's, I think the math becomes problematic.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. Actually, I think within the language of your bill, in section 10, E, it says each year the legislature may appropriate from the earnings reserve account to the general fund an amount that does not exceed the amount available for distribution under the, so you kind of already have up to language, mm-hmm. in the bill.
The language in the bill makes the 5.25 a maximum draw, basically.
Just a quick follow-up, okay.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you.
I just think, though, just to state for the record, that if we draw a little less on an annual basis, it leaves a little more left in the earnings reserve. So in the event that we have a 2 or more year loss of the fund, we have within that cushion in the earnings reserve, so we don't have then a huge drop in income or ability to draw. And so, again, 25 basis points or 0.25% can make a difference in those rough years.
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, if up to language doesn't do any damage to the bill whatsoever, as long as you leave your maximum at the 5.25.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, could you help me here a little bit? I want to talk the draw limit is helps us as well, because when we have high years of earnings, we're increasing the corpus of the earnings reserve account. So there's another safeguard in there going along with your Section 10. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the draw limit will impact more, is more tied to increasing oil prices than increasing returns, because the trigger is when oil prices hit a certain level, you start reducing the size. So increased earnings, increased draw, because you've got a larger dividend, actually is money that would be available for expenditure. Available. Doesn't have to be appropriated.
Senator Bishop, follow up?
I'll follow up with you.
Senator Machicki.
Well, however, it does serve as an averaging mechanism, and it does diversify. I mean, it truly does diversify both revenue streams, right? I mean, you'll agree with that. That's the value of it, is when inevitably oil prices will be high at some point in this, higher at some point in this time horizon, and at that time you're diversifying use of your sovereign investments by lessening the requirement for a draw. So it certainly serves as an, it actually serves both Senator Von Imhoff's and Senator Bishop's concerns with the reduction in the draw in high oil price years.
And through the chair, Senator Machicki, that's correct.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, please continue.
Moving on to slide 22 then. Talk a little bit about the draw limit. The draw limit reduces the percent of market value draw by $1 for every dollar that exceed UGF production taxes and royalties that exceed $1.2 billion. And again, this doesn't apply to the amount going to the dividend, so that if your draw becomes lessened on your PMV draw is lessened because of high oil prices, it doesn't have an incremental reduction on your dividend as well. The dividend's always factored based on your maximum draw. So what does that look like then? Well, this graphically kind of shows how the draw from the earnings reserve essentially starts to shut itself off as oil prices or royalties and production taxes increase. And so starting somewhere in the around $75 to $80 a barrel on oil prices, you see start to see a reduction in the draw, and at about $110, you've completely shut off your draw completely, $110 oil price, and then of course after that you've kind of got uncapped revenues, because you no longer have any earnings reserve draw. All you're back kind of right where you are right now, where you're relying entirely on your royalty and tax, oil and gas royalty and tax revenues. But that's then again where the appropriation cap starts to come into play, that the additional piece that this bill has that other bills don't have. So if you look at what that really leaves then is as far as revenues available, this chart, the blue bar is your status quo revenue. That's the revenue from your existing taxes and fees and oil. The yellow would be the planned permanent fund withdrawals. And then the green is the difference between the Office of Management and Budget and the revenues from those two revenue sources. And that's where your other fiscal measures come into play. And that's where you either have to additional budget cuts to fill that gap, or new revenues, or withdrawals from non-permanent fund savings, such as a CBR. So that's the part that needs to be filled from other sources, even after the permanent fund is in play.
Commissioner, in those sources, you're talking about other sources of options to deal with a deficit, which would be cutting or revenue. Is that what you're?
That is correct. Or use of other savings other than the permanent fund.
Senator Machicki.
Just a question. You may have said it. I have two questions. Can you go back one more slide? At what oil price point does the draw from the ERA begin to decline?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I'll have to go back and actually pull the numbers. I'm just looking at the chart itself, and it looks like it's in that $80 price point where you start to see the decline. But I can get you an actual number from the numbers versus the graphical representation.
And then next slide, is that curve or that trend? That's the actual CPI trend?
On the Office of Management Budget, that is CPI for agency type operations, and then actual increases that are forecasted for like PERS, TERS on behalf and things like that.
Thank you.
So How durable are these various components then? Let's start with the dividend itself. $1,000 per person for the first 3 years, then 25% of the percent of market value draw. Is that durable under this plan? This chart is a little bit complicated, but essentially the part to look at is the line where the yellow and the blue meet. This shows a distribution of the various results that occurred in the probabilistic modeling. So you've got the range between the 25 and 75% probability. 25 to the median is the blue. The median to 75% is the yellow. And then the whiskers on either end is kind of the extent of other results that occurred within, you know, thousands of runs of this probabilistic modeling. But you'll see that. So if you just kind of follow that line between the yellow and the blue, you're starting out with a $1,000 dividend. In 2041, your dividend would be about $1,600 under this plan, and about $940 is the real value of that using a 2.25% inflation rate. So essentially, the buying power of your dividend would remain through the life of the 24-year forecasting. As far as inflation proofing the fund and itself and making the fund size durable, AS 3713-145C provides for annual inflation proofing from the earnings reserve to the corpus. But you need to add to that the fact that the earnings reserve needs to have a sufficient balance to be able to meet draws each year. So you have to have, you not only have to have durability in the fund itself, you have to have durability in the earnings reserve in order to make sure that you've always have revenues available. So this bill provides for the earnings reserve balance over four times the maximum draw is transmitted into the corpus of the fund for inflation proofing. So it's kind of an automatic trigger that would still have to appropriate the money back in, but if the calculation would say there's money available now to transfer back into the corpus of the fund when you hit four times the maximum draw within the earnings reserve. And as we model that, and we thought this was critical, because it's not a direct inflation proofing. It's not figure out the CPI each year and put it back into the corpus. So we model this to say, does this work over the life of the fund to actually build up the corpus of the fund and meet the inflation proofing requirement? And if you look at the next slide, you'll see that in fact does occur. Again, looking at the bar between the yellow and the blue tells you what the total fund value is through the life of the forecast. So the 2041 median value is $112 billion nominal, which is $66 billion real when you account for inflation. Remember, we started with a fund that just a little bit less than $55 billion, so you'll see that it's actually grown at a rate greater than inflation over the period of the forecast. And one other critical component here is how often would we actually run out of the earnings reserve within this? And there's less than 1% of the times that somewhere in the 24-year span that the earnings reserve dropped to zero. So essentially there's no risk of earnings reserve failure.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Michicki.
Thank you. Please go back to slide 24, which is kind of important, a point that I meant to get out. Does this plan include inflation and escalation, Senate Bill 70? Does it provide for?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, the plan itself allows for the fund to grow with inflation. It also allows for budget growth with inflation, because under the appropriations cap, it allows for inflation within that as well.
I say that there was an article written of someone who misunderstood, thinking that this was a flat funded plan. Just wanted to get that out for the public. The other thing I'd like to understand is our numbers show that the rise in the value of the fund and therefore the value of the POMV has our budget balancing by around 24 or so. So I'd like to see your assumptions in the green that creates the green line. What we do openly admit is if we go into a long period of a downward trend in oil prices, that we will likely have to supplement with other revenue. I'd like to understand the assumptions that you use. I don't need it on the record today because I'm sure you have some details that we will share with the public, but we would like to understand those assumptions.
And through the chair, Secretary, we will get together with Ledge Legal. I actually think it's how inflation is dealt with in the budget component that's creating the difference between the two. But we'll get an exact reason for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
See, we were on slide 30.
Slide 30.
We can jump to slide 32. I think we already talked about that.
You go back to slide 30.
Okay. Senator Hoffman, on slide 30.
So on slide 30, many people are very concerned about the health of the fund itself. And with this plan, according to your calculations, Senate Bill 70, under the medium case scenario, the fund would reach approximately $100 billion by 2037. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hoffbeck, please continue.
Slide 32. And this is where we get into, and I've just got a couple of slides here, but really looking at the three components. One is SB 70 as a standalone bill. SB 70 with $750 million in cuts, and then SB 70 with essentially a revenue package that would fill the gap versus the cuts, just to see the relative difference and why it's important that we do more than just the permanent fund bill as far as solving the fiscal situation. So the dotted line is the revenues that would be available under status quo. The blue dashed line is SB 70 by itself. And what happens is that when it's by itself, you end up with unplanned cuts at some point in time. Once the CBR is depleted, you start having to use extra revenues from the earnings reserve, and so you see that it has a negative impact on the durability of the fund. In fact, if you did just an SB 70 only with no other fiscal measures, you actually have about a 45% failure rate going forward. Status quo has a 99% failure rate, and status quo will fail. And then the real value of the fund would be about $55 billion under this. So it would still maintain its the real value of the fund, even with no other measures, but it would just be hanging on. Under status quo, you'd have about a $37 billion fund. You'd start to deplete the value of the fund. The yellow and the green, SB 70 with $750 million cuts, or SB 70 with a revenue package, essentially have the same durability. It's pretty much 100% sure thing that you've got a durable, lasting fund under those. So there is some work to do, even after passing a permanent fund bill, to get to the final solution.
Senator Machicki.
I am assuming that you've gone with the past curve of production decline in order to get to this point, which is why the further out you have it, the more you show production declining, or at least the value of oil declining. There's not something else that would get us there. If we produced at today's rate for 25 more years, which is possible, and I agree that the further out we go, the more difficult it is, but you obviously have today's decline rate, or some decline rate from the past, plugged into this, or those numbers don't work.
So the Chair, Senator Machicki, that's correct. We're using the fall forecast from the Department of Revenue fall forecast, and I believe Dan Stickle had done a presentation, and really we look at 5 years out, and then after that just a decline. We don't look at new fields more than 5 years out, and certainly there's several fields that are very likely to occur, Pica and Willow, that are just outside that 5-year window, and those are not included in our forecast numbers here.
Thank you.
Slide 33 then talks about the dividend per person, and under status quo and under SB 70 with the cuts and SB 70 with a revenue plan, you can see that although status quo maintains dividends at a much higher rate for a period of time, that by 2024, 2025, you see a precipitous drop off and then essentially no dividends. Once the earnings reserve is depleted, there is no ability to pay dividends, and the dividends would drop to zero. Under the other plans, there's not a substantial difference in the size of the dividend until you get out to the 2027, 2028 range, and that's where you'd start making these additional draws against the earnings reserve. And so you start to see a little bit of a degradation in the size of the dividend with a dividend-only bill. And again, cuts or revenues is relatively inconsequential which solution is used as far as the size of the dividend moving forward. And then the funds available for governor's services, we see essentially the same type of impact. The status quo would just simply be using whatever monies are available in the earnings reserve once the CBR was depleted. The other three, again, start to diverge at about 2027, 2028, when you have to start making additional draws against the earnings reserve. But it creates relatively similar revenues out to about that time period. So, conclusion. Just kind of putting these in a chart on, you know, the five against the five rules, and you know, do they check the boxes? Status quo largely does not check any of the boxes. SB 70 alone will check the boxes for a period of time, but then once the earnings reserve is depleted, it starts to have some of the same issues that the status quo does, that you start to spend down your earnings reserve. SB 70 with a full fiscal plan or with a full fiscal plan is what we'd used in others. It should, to be fair, again, so it'd be SB 70 with a revenue plan versus SB 70 with a $750 million in cuts. Essentially, check all the boxes. They would get a partial stabilization of the income because of using the 5-year averaging, but there's still some variability that occurs even with a 5-year average. And then on total revenue, we get a partial. Although if I had to go back and redo this slide right now, under SB 70, that there really is under a revenue plan, it probably would be a full total revenue It would check the box fully. You'd probably put a yes there. And the only reason I say that it would be yes under a revenue plan and not under the $750 million in cuts is that when you make $750 million in cuts, you've got that $750 million headroom between the current appropriations limit that's in the bill and what you'd actually be drawing out, because you'd have cut the budget $750 million. So there'd still be some pressure to try and fill that void with underneath the cap. So, but essentially, they check all the boxes. Slide 37 shows the impact of the SB 70.
We have a question back, sure, on that slide. Senator Machicki.
I think maximize ERA use, the second box in for Senate Bill 70 alone, is missing some text. I think the red overuse is overstated, and I think what I'd like to see is an overlay chart that has oil prices. So we're kind of going with the fall forecast, and I support that. That's what we know today. Well, it's what we assume today. Substantive increase in oil prices, and I'm not talking $20 across the board. I'm talking about $5 or $6 across the board, paints a very different picture on the upside. And a long-term decline in $5 or $6 or $10 in the oil price over time then paints a very negative picture. Is that something that you can provide a range on that chart? Because I do believe that box is overstated. We're trying to make the best decision that's politically possible this year that largely covers our fiscal gap, and we're certainly willing to have those other discussions depending on what happens with the price of oil and production levels and our success in cuts and that sort of thing going forward. But I do want the public to understand that I feel that overuse box on line 5 for Senate Bill 70 alone is perhaps it shouldn't be read and might have the word potential overuse before it with some verbiage and understanding that price fluctuations on oil is going to dramatically impact the outcome.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, that's a fair criticism. If I put the governor's plan up here, I would have had exactly that same comment in there. So it's a fair criticism as far as maybe that needs to be a little more explanation on all of them. If you actually go back to slide 30 on the full fiscal plan, you kind of do see some of the range that, you know, there is a broad range there. And that does take into account. We did do probabilistic modeling on production in there as well as price. And so you can see that there's a pretty broad range that it actually can fall into within that. But we can get you numbers associated with that chart, but I think you can see that we're picking one line in a pretty broad range.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same lines, we're looking at line 3 where you're talking about the protection of the dividend, mm-hmm. and you say the dividend at risk when the ERA is depleted. But if you could revert to slide 27, which shows the dividend, it shows it here rising to above $1,500 around in about 11 years or 21 years. How does that slide rectify with your comments on slide 36?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the slide 27 assumes that there's some package that fills the void and that there's no additional draws against the earnings reserve. We actually do have some slides that model what would happen to the dividend without that filling that void, and they do show a declining dividend. Once you have to start tapping into the earnings reserve, we didn't include that in this particular package, but it does. There is some degradation that occurs.
And what year does that decline occur?
Starts in again in that 2027, 2028 range where you're starting to tap into the earnings.
And do you have a dollar amount of how much it's going to be declining?
I through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I can get that for you.
Yes, I think the margin of error of decline is. Could be questionable, and the slide that people are going to be concerned about is the one that you have where the dividend, which is slide number 33, which shows that in the out years there is no dividend, and I think what the Senate is trying to accomplish here is. To show that what we're trying to do is protect the dividend, and the average of the dividend has been about $1,000 over the course of time, and Senate Bill number 70 captures that dividend at $1,000 and ensures that dividend is ongoing for. The foreseeable future at $1,000. So what many have portrayed as taking the people's dividend can be viewed in one regard, but what we're trying to accomplish is what is on slide number 33, which is that if we do not take any action, the dividend will be eliminated. And I think the general public needs to understand that, at least from my viewpoint, the dividend is very important. There are many different variations of plans, but at least this plan, number one, comes forward and protects the dividend. And if we look at the quadrant that we have on Senate Bill 70, and I know we don't have that one. You have with the model with $300 million cuts, but the model that we have on by Ledge Finance shows that the fund itself increases every single year, starting out with the exhausting funds in fiscal year 18 at 17 years, and you go out to fiscal year 20, the fund exhausts at 28 years, and at fiscal 24, you're exhausting the fund at 50 years, and at 26, the fund would be exhausted at 254 years. So although there are many different variables in here, from the best estimates of Ledge Finance, the plan that the Senate is proposing protects the fund itself and extends that out 250 years in out years, and protects the dividend in the long run from being exhausted by no action by the legislature, as is depicted in slide 33.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we will get together with Ledge Finance because we want the numbers to speak for themselves and not have an issue between the way that they've been modeled. Again, I think it's the way that inflation in the budget was treated within the models, but we will get that confirmed. Under our model, under this one, if you look at, you ask the question, what the size of the dividend would be. In this one, in 2041, the real value of the dividend would be about $750 million with no other plans. So the dividend wouldn't go away, but it would have a little bit lower real buying power. I think the nominal value on it was about $1,200 in 2041, if there was no other adjustments made. But again, we will reconcile the difference between the Ledge Finance and our numbers and make sure that we're working with one set of numbers.
So the point I think that I'm trying to make here, Madam Chair, is that if we do nothing, we have a $3 billion deficit. And what options will we have if the CBR is depleted?
Yep.
If the CBR were depleted today, what would our options be? And I think that what is being proposed by this plan, we have the luxury of a $4 billion buffer, but we also have to realize that four short years ago, we had a $17 billion buffer. And I know that the governor understands that, but that just shows the magnitude of the situation that the legislature is in to take some action. And although the Senate has taken action last year, inaction is not an option.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Machicki.
Again, on slide 33, I just want to caution folks that we are modeling an assumption in decline and oil prices 12 years out from now. And that's just something we don't know. There are things in the future that will cause us to have to adjust one way or another. One of the things that were written about this is that someone make a statement that we said that taxes were never going to be necessary. And because of what we don't know in those out years about production and price, we all openly admit that if we have a gap because of a dramatic reduction in both or either, that we will likely have to adjust with some sort of broad-based revenue solution. Our modeling shows that if things sort of continue status quo, or if we have an increase, not even a dramatic increase, but an increase in the price of oil of 10% or so, that things look much rosier than our modeling. And if we have a decrease that's similar in proportion, that we will likely have to respond with something else. So that's my only point on the difference between the SB 70 line alone and the SB 70 with cuts or a full fiscal plan are things that are difficult to predict today. Would you agree with that?
To the Chair, Senator Machicki, yes. This is our this is the median. It's our best estimate, but we recognize that it's within a range of an estimate. It's hard to plot a range, so we plotted a single point. But, 10 years out, 20 years out, you know, the only thing you're sure of is you're going to be wrong. So.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the Chair, thank you. On 33, through the Chair, the hash mark that shows the status quo and the dividend disappearing, just for clarification, is that a mechanical or mathematical issue, or is that the assumption that the legislature will be driven to take more out of the ERA?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, it's based on the assumption that that once the CBR is depleted, that then the next step would be to start using the monies that are available for appropriation in the earnings reserve.
Thank you. And I just wanted to just get that on the record, because some folks have called me when they've seen this and they've said, what is the mechanical or mathematical issue that's causing the dividend to go to zero? And it's just important to note that it's the assumption that we will go into the fund to draw more to cover our deficits is what will deplete the dividend, not some mechanical or mathematical or investment error. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Bishop.
I'm going to yield to the senator to my right, because I think her question is going to dovetail with Senator Dunleavy's, and then I'll come back.
Senator Von Imhoff.
I think what's this slide also shows is that the status quo of spending remains, meaning, and I'm stating the obvious, is if people would rather have money in a dividend, then the trade-off is having less money in government services.
To the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that's exactly right.
And the challenge from the Senate's perspective is maintaining or holding cuts in budgets or advancing legislation that can be agreed to by both bodies. Senator Bishop?
Thank you. So we talk about assumptions, but we're at a point in time in Alaska's history. Now, we can look back 30 years ago, and we didn't know as much in 85, 86, and 87, because our production curve was continuing to increase and didn't peak until 1990. Been a lot said here today about the decline curve going forward. Let that be a lesson learned, and let's not squander that opportunity. We need to deal in as much as we can in absolutes going forward, this is just my opinion, because we don't want to repeat this in 25 years, come back, and there'd be a different set of people here having to deal with a similar problem. And I've said it last year, I think we all want to try to eliminate ever having to come to a crisis like this again. It's been termed a crisis. The governor spoke at it as that way. We've got real people losing jobs. So this is a good plan. It's a good starting point to put Alaska's pathway going forward on a sustainable footing. We're still a one-trick pony. It's oil. And that declining curve that Senator Machicki keeps talking about, it's going to flatten out. But in time, the Yankee whaling fleet was replaced by crude oil in Pennsylvania. Someday, we all read, oil is continuing to be displaced around the globe as new technology comes along. We need to continue to insulate ourselves, look at other forms of revenue, protect our assets in Alaska's future. So I just been wanting to say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Hoffbeck, you had a couple slides left.
Slide 37 is just, I think, goes to the point that several of you have made, and that's the how much does SB 70 resolve the issue. So under the status quo and under SB 70, both of them are starting with a $4.3 billion budget, which is the governor's budget that was proposed. Under status quo, you'd have about $1.6 billion in revenues. Under SB 70, you have about $1.7 because you've moved some of the royalties into the revenue side for the new oil. So it has a little bit more revenue than under status quo. Then you've got the plan draw available net of a dividend is about $1.9 billion. So under status quo, you have a $2.8 billion deficit. Under SB 70, you're working with about a $700 million deficit. So you've substantially closed the fiscal situation. There's still $700 million is still a lot. I mean, the only reason that $700 million seems like a little bit is because we started at $3 billion, but $700 million is still a lot. It's a lot of work. It's going to be a lot of work to close that last $700 million. And then the final slide just kind of goes back against our five tests against SB 70. It does provide for a rule-based framework for use of the permanent fund earnings reserve. It does stabilize the budget related to oil and gas revenues and permanent fund earnings, and also limits spending on all revenues because of the additional appropriation cap. It protects the dividend, it protects an inflation, adjusts the value of the permanent fund, and it maximizes the use of the earnings reserve. And with that, I would say that it checks all the boxes that the governor asked for a plan to have. And with that, I would open it up for additional questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Commissioner, thank you for your presentation today. One final question. If asked, does the governor support or the administration support SB 70?
Senator, we'll support any bill that checks all the boxes, and this one checks all the boxes. So I think by inference, I would say that we would support this plan.
If you have any feedback specific that you want to provide us on inflation proofing, we'd be happy to take that under consideration.
Okay.
With that, I will take a brief at ease while we change out presenters. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We have before us SB 70. I'd like to invite Angela Rodell from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to the table. She does not have a formal presentation, but is here to answer any questions that the committee might have on SB 70 and its effects on the permanent fund itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Angela Rodell, Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Ms. Rodell, do you have any kind of statement that you'd like to make for the committee's consideration in review of SB 70?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of observations that I wanted to make from our perspective as I was listening to the earlier testimony. And I think one of the important things to point out that is in this bill is that there is an intent to review after 3 years what the effect is on the earnings reserve account by the 5.25% draw. It is timed right when the draw would step down to the 5%. So I think it's going to be really important at that 3-year mark to do a look back and see sort of how the mechanics of the bill are working. And I think that aspect of it is really helpful going forward. The second thing I wanted to note is that the inflation-proofing provision in this bill, it's important that this legislation recognizes the importance of inflation-proofing on the corpus and that that is how the corpus grows for future generations. I just wanted to state for the record, Madam Chair, just an observation that there is not a reconciliation to whatever actual inflation might be. So the provision that anything in excess of 4 times the draw may be appropriated into the corpus, if it's $5 million, it's $5 million, and inflation could be something very different than that. And so I just wanted to note for the record that there is not a reconciliation or a true-up in any way as to what actual inflation might have been. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There has been some discussion about the 5.35 payout, and we have it set at that rate for 3 years and dropping down to 5%. And the dialogue has always been whether or not this amount protects the corpus of the fund. And I'm wondering, and there's been some dialogue about 5 of the last 6 years using a rolling average. Does the corporation have concerns about this and any comments about that rolling average, about the level of 5.5. I know other pieces of legislation have it down to 4.5 or 4.75.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we don't have any concerns about the 5.25% draw and the step down to the 5% draw. They're reasonable numbers. I think the certainty that the 5 out of the last 6 years provides for us in terms of managing the investment portfolio is key, is the key piece of that.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So through the chair, Ms. Rodell, I'd like to go back to your comments regarding inflation proofing. By all means, inflation proofing is an important mechanism to incorporate in a plan, but there are many ways to skin a cat. And the calculation that is in existence now and in statute is a good one, but it's not the only one, or the only option. It was probably arguably more appropriate while the fund was growing in its early infancy years. Now that the fund is collectively about over $50+ billion, there are other ways to inflation-proof the fund through earnings mix, through investments, choosing, how we do the draw, et cetera. We can list those out on paper later. But I guess while you emphasize the importance of inflation proofing, again, there are many ways to do it. So we just need to put our heads together and make sure that we incorporate it in an appropriate way and not necessarily in the exact same way that the statute is in now. is my thought. Do you have a comment on that? Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Von Himhoff, you're absolutely correct. And I think that if all things being equal, we had one fund, and we had just one fund, there was no earnings reserve account, there was no corpus, there was one fund, it would be a lot easier. The challenge we have is that the earnings reserve account, we talk about the fund being $55 billion. Today, the fund is $57 billion. But the fund is not $57 billion. The fund is made up of two very different accounts, a savings account, which is the corpus, which cannot be spent, and a checking account, which is the earnings reserve account. And so the earnings reserve account has about $10.5 billion of that $57 billion today. And so while it may seem strange about how I emphasize inflation proofing, it's to get through the emphasis and to emphasize the very real legal distinction between the savings account that cannot be spent and maintaining the investment power of that particular piece of the fund, that is the fund, and the checking account that is the earnings reserve account, because you have and have always had the ability since the fund was created, since the earnings reserve account was created, to appropriate the balance in the earnings reserve account in its entirety with a simple majority. And that has not changed. And what is changing today is that there has been, over the years, a treatment of the earnings reserve account in many ways as a sacred cow. It is not to be touched. And so the reason we're having, I think the legislature is really struggling with this, is because it has always been treated as something special, when in fact the legal structure around it has meant that you could have spent it at any time. And as you're planning to use the earnings reserve account in a different way than you have in the past, you have to recognize also that you have the right and the authority to spend it all in its entirety if that is what it comes down to. And that's to the point in the presentation earlier about how dividends could go to zero, because without a potential change, the possibility exists that you have to use all of the earnings reserve account to fund budgets. And so what I'm saying on inflation proofing is important because that's how you get money into the non-spendable portion of the permanent fund. It protects the investments in the corpus of the fund, and it maintains the investment power of the corpus.
Ms. Riddell, follow up on Senator Von Imhoff's question about different ways that the fund is changed over time. In its infancy, when there was very little in it, we were heavily invested in bonds or stocks, and now we have unrealized gains sitting in the corpus of the fund in real estate, which is a significant holding. Is that not what Senator Von Imhoff is referring to as other ways that the fund has, over time, since it's gotten bigger and been able to broaden its asset allocation into more fixed, that there is some inflation proofing that is happening in some fixed assets that the state owns in the permanent fund corpus itself?
Madam Chair, you are correct. As long as those gains remain unrealized. The challenge is the minute we go to realize those gains because we want to make a shift. So, for example, we believe it's time to take some chips off the table in a certain real estate market or a certain sector within real estate, and we want to put them elsewhere, redeploy them. If I go to sell that asset that has a realized gain, let's say it was $100 million, now it's worth $200 million, that $100 million all goes to the earnings reserve account and is available for spend. It is not going back into the corpus, allowing the corpus to buy another $200 million asset. All the corpus has to buy a new asset is the original $100 million it invested in the real estate 10, 15, 20 years ago.
So with that on the table in consideration of inflation proofing, is there something that we could insert into a bill that would provide fixed asset compensation to make that part of the corpus and retained in the corpus?
versus investment earning. If there's a portfolio mix, and again, I don't want the permanent fund corporation waging against the legislature in trying to hold all of its assets and then not creating interest earnings for dividends. So we are obligated. You are obligated. It is your primary function to protect the corpus. So do you have language that we could help with inflation on those fixed assets? Say a portfolio couldn't exceed 25% of fixed assets, and if you were moving inside of that 25% fixed, then that money would be directly deposited back as you realize those earnings. If there's a way to help, you know, that's what we're asking.
Madam Chair, I truly appreciate this discussion. I think the challenge we're facing is that because the earnings reserve account is, you know, the Constitution's very clear, income goes to the general fund. And the earnings reserve account is available for appropriation. The cleanest legal way is to appropriate back as you have done for since 1982. And it makes it the cleanest in terms of how that calculated. And so you do have it in Senate Bill 70. You do have a mechanism for appropriating money back into the corpus, and it's based on a different formula than has been used in the past. And all I wanted to point out was that just recognize the differences in the formula. The formula being proposed doesn't actually speak to inflation itself. It just recognizes that at some point there may be some excess that we want to put back into the corpus and help recover the inflation differentials that may have happened over the years.
Ms. Rodell, is there a formal process that we could insert, or is it already in existence, to provide the corporation and the board of directors comfort? That's what I'm looking for. Another way, as Senator Von Himhoff said, there are multiple ways we could go forward. Is there a way, when we look at the permanent fund itself, the corpus being permanent savings for this generation and the next of Alaskans, and as you referred to it, the earnings reserve of more of a checking account, if we think about it like that, sometimes there's minimum balances in checking accounts that are required so that there's not fees paid. Is there comfort in a minimum balance that needs to be retained so that we're protecting both the dividend and what the corporation needs for flexibility? So I'm trying to put it in the terms that you've described for the public. Is there a minimum balance that we need to have set in the ERA so that we can make sure that we remain healthy at all times? And so again, in the effort to brainstorm about inflation and an opportunity that you've highlighted to provide clarity for the people of Alaska and comfort. Two times the last 5 years, the average of the last 5 years' dividends. I mean, so that we can make sure that Alaskans know that we don't see, a dividend to zero like was presented in a slide earlier this morning.
Madam Chair, absolutely, and we can go back and look and see what we would think a healthy balance in the earnings reserve account, so that if there is language that it wouldn't be drawn below a balance, or it's not the intent to draw below, we could definitely take a look at that.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Just to build upon Senator McKinnon, I think that I'd like to know what your thoughts are. In a traditional sense, when you have a fund, there usually isn't an earnings reserve fund and then a corpus. That's kind of an anomaly. Normally what you have is a fund, and then the managers manage the investment mix and make sure that there's liquidity available for the annual draw that's generally predictable. You spend the year kind of calculating it, tweaking it as you go to figure out what the amount is. Do you think that model makes sense? Do you think that's somewhere that we could move to towards the future, which is more of a traditional model that you see in most foundations and funds?
Through the chair, Senator Von Himhoff, the trustees put forward a resolution in 2004, and they've not rescinded the resolution, which is to advocate for a constitutional amendment that would change the way the language currently reads, that invested of which income goes to the general fund, and B is straight up POMV on the full value of the fund. It would roll the earnings reserve account into the corpus of the fund, and you would have one fund of which an annual draw amount would come off on a percent of market value and hand it over to the general fund. I'm sure there are many who could talk to you about how that went, but this is not a constitutional amendment to enshrine the dividend. This was just about changing the draw calculation, because the way it works right now, and it was done before GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, changed in 1997 with regard to income. In 2005, we removed the legislative list of investments, so we were allowed to have a broad diversification of those investments. So, yes, to answer your question, it would be great to be able to move to that, and the Board of Trustees supports that.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. That would kill two birds with one stone, if you will, and allow the inflation proofing to be more robust and capture more than the current calculation that we have now, as well as it would give the permanent fund corporation the flexibility to manage the assets and all the assets in the highest and best use of an asset mix with the market that we have today. It is generally the more traditional method and is found to be the most lucrative. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The four-time rule already addresses the fact that the corpus can grow by inflation. But when we went and looked at the slide that the commissioner gave us, slide 30, it showed that the corpus of the permanent fund would grow in value over the course of 20 years to a balance of $100 billion. And I'm wondering if that's something that you agree with.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think this is possible. I think it's important to note that it looks like this is based on the assumption of a full fiscal plan, so it's allowed to grow because the earnings reserve account is not being drawn upon because other parts, this is assuming other parts, whether revenue or spending cuts come into play, and the earnings reserve account then is not needed to use that. So it's certainly possible.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. Ms. Riddell, I think we'd all agree that perhaps the legislature has not always been disciplined on spending in high revenue years, but I think we can also demonstrate that they have been disciplined on protecting the corpus. And by protecting, I mean by overinflation proofing by billions of dollars. Could you provide us, not today, but could you provide us with how much has been redeposited over the statutory and constitutional requirements since the birth of the fund? And I guess the reason I'm saying that is, aside from the Section 10, subsection F, four times the POMV payout that will be redeposited, I mean, I know for one, when we get back into high revenue years, which will inevitably happen at some proportion of the years going forward, I certainly would support getting back into that overinflation proofing. But I think one could argue that we're far above the statutory inflation proofing that's suggested, and perhaps that carries us at some point into the future as well, just from the billions that have been deposited.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, we can get you the detailed information due to the excess royalty that were done by statute.
Brief at ease.
We're back on the record. The Permanent Fund Corporation presented to the committee a few weeks ago, and so we just pulled that presentation to provide Ms. Rodell the information that she gave to us then so that she could refer to it. Ms. Rodell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in response, what we can do, Senator Michiki, is get to you the specifics as to what was actual excess royalty. But just in general, $29.1 billion has been sort of saved in addition to the regular royalty. So this was excess appropriations to the extent that there were times early on when the earnings reserve account was first created, there were times where the legislature chose to sweep the balance in the earnings reserve account and put it into the corpus of the account. There have been times where they've also felt like it was prudent to appropriate additional monies into that. So if you subtract out the roughly $10 billion out of that $29 billion that's in the earnings reserve account right now, that gets you to about $19 billion. $16 billion is roughly the inflation calculation that's done. So there's been in excess of another $3 billion in excess over that $16 billion. But we'll get to you more detailed information as to what it's, but just in rough general numbers.
So Madam Chair,
Senator Michiki.
My point was, and my colleague next to me pointed out that the legislature was on a saving spree back then, which I think is worthy of recognizing. There has been a lot of discipline on protecting the fund and over-inflation-proofing the fund, and I certainly want the public to understand that although we have some objectives on use of the earnings reserve, that I don't think there's anyone at this table or even in this legislature that would not continue to feed the fund. I mean, I know my vision for the future is a fully sustainable draw from the permanent fund that will eliminate the need in perpetuity for broad-based taxes. I think it's within reach, and compromising that by not adequately inflation-proofing the fund is certainly something that's not in my interest. I think we've got it in this bill. I'm certainly interested in learning your feelings, I hope we get back to the days where we can continue to deposit over and above the required amounts that we've done in the past. And I certainly, history shows that on this roller coaster ride of a single commodity economy, that we will get there at some point, hopefully.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rodell, maybe you're not the person to be asking this question, but prior to your tenure as the Revenue Commissioner, there was a significant loss to the permanent fund because of the lack of, and this is maybe 10, 12 years ago, when there was, during, I guess, your predecessor, there was a significant loss in the permanent fund because of the lack in the timing of a transfer of funds back then. And so I guess this SB 70 or any other legislation protect us from that significant loss that took place over a very short period of time because of the untimely transfer?
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, I believe you're referring to the transfer that was made when the creation of a subaccount in the Constitutional Budget Reserve was made and monies were transferred in, and unfortunately it was right, and equities were bought at a high price point, and then they took some time to recover, but there was an immediate loss. I think both the permanent fund and the investments of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, one of the things we're always balancing is the short-term need and the recognition of one-year market volatility and the expectation for using that money. There, what you have in terms of protection from some of that in some ways is limiting the amount of the draw. It's not complete protection. There could be events like 2009, which no one saw, which were much deeper and much more extreme. We try to avoid that at the permanent fund by or minimizing, I should say, the impact of that by creating a much more diversified portfolio so that we don't get overexposed. The issue with that is you may not get as much when markets are high, but you don't lose as much when markets drop. And I think that points out one other thing. When I was mentioning the fact that we talk about the fund as one fund, in current statute, we are asked to invest the earnings reserve account in a similar manner to the corpus of the fund. And that has been interpreted over the years that we will prorate each investment. So if it's a 1-to-5 ratio, we will take $1 of the earnings reserve account and $5 of the corpus to buy each investment. So every security, every asset owned by the fund is owned partially by the earnings reserve account and partially by the corpus of the account. And when that changes is when we start to realize gains and reinvest and the shift that happens. I think one of the things to note that is if, and this is why the three-year look back is so important, because if things are happening in the market where the fund is not able to grow as we forecasted or expected, and the draws are happening for some reason, they're a little bit larger or because of the way the balance works, and the earnings reserve account is coming down maybe faster than anticipated, it may require us to shift and create a different asset allocation than the corpus to recognize exactly what you're talking about, that there needs to be a maintenance of safety in that account in a way that we haven't had to think about in the past.
So you have the statutory authority to go ahead and do that?
Mm-hmm. We do.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff? Other questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Riddell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? On tomorrow's agenda, we'll have our first hearing on SB 57. It's an ADA bill, dividend to the state, income valuation. SB 14, transportation network companies, has been removed from our agenda in order to do some more technical changes. With that, we're adjourned.